My beloved brethren and sisters, I had a smile when I came to the Campsie New Hall because a brother besought me that I would not tear up the floorboards. Now that may seem rather strange to you who were not at the Bible school, but in commenting on the Apostle Paul's experiences in toil and hardship, to many a sleepless night in hunger and thirst, often without cold and in exposure, we recalled an anecdote how at Grand Valley, when we were snowed out from getting home one day, we had to take refuge in Campania United Church. In order to keep warm, we tore up the floorboards of the church and built a fire in the middle of the church. So it was kind of funny to come here this evening and find that Campsie's New Hall was in fact a church, formerly. But anyway, brothers and sisters, the study that we have tonight deals with a great man, the divine purpose, Nehemiah, a man of faith, a man of word, and a man of action. And it's our purpose tonight to see the background to the work of Nehemiah. To do this, we will peruse some of the late history of the kings of Judah and Israel. We will take a look at the great work of revival by Joshua and Zerubbabel. See the ministration of God's prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, because it's in this setting that we come to consider the great work of Nehemiah, a man come to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Now, in 2 Kings, we have here some valuable lessons for us. Chapter 15. We have a repeating pattern in Israel's history. In 2 Kings chapter 15, reading at verse 17, in the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menahem the son of Gadai began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 10 years in Samaria, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart all his days from all the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. By the way, I'm reading from the American Revised Standard Version. Pul the king of Assyria came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver that he might help him to confirm his hold of the royal power. Menahem exacted the money from Israel, that is, from all the wealthy men, 50 shekels of silver from every man to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land. So you see, there were all sorts of decisions made out of expediency in the history of the two kings we'll peruse now. First of all, Menahem attempted to establish himself with his hold on the royal power by seeking help from Pul, king of Assyria. And as inevitably happened in the Chronicles account, we read what took place. I'll just read these words for you. So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away, namely the Reubenites, the Gadites, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to Halah, Habor, and Hara, and the river Gozan to this day. So although Menahem, attempting to manipulate the political environment of his day to retain his hold on the royal power, he rested on a rod that pierced his hand, because the very king that he thought would hold him in royal power was later to take into captivity people of the children of Israel. In chapter 16, there was a political alliance between Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel. And so we have again the political powers uniting. We have Rezin, king of Syria, in the north. We have King Ahaz in the south. And we have Pekah, king of Israel, in the north. And Ahaz sees an alliance forming between Pekah and Rezin, king of Syria. And so we read what he does in verse 7. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant, and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are attacking me. Ahaz also took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house, and sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria hearkened to him. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying his people captive to Kir, and he killed Rezin. So you see, the kings of Israel were attempting, by the exigencies of the circumstances, to secure a position in their day. And faithless Ahaz, rather than resting on the unseen chariots of Yahweh of hosts, he undertook a policy whereby he purchased support from Tiglath-Pileser in Assyria, who then came back and killed Rezin, king of Syria. And so to secure his political position, Ahaz resorted to intrigue that violated principles of God's dealings with Israel. Time and again, the prophets of Israel thundered against such movements. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but do not look to the Holy One of Israel. Now we may wonder how men, in view of such notable history, where God intervened on behalf of Israel, could ever stoop to such foolish political alliances. Because every time they rested on Tiglath-Pileser or Pul, or went down to Sol, king of Egypt, for assistance for horsemen and chariots, they paid a bitter price, brothers and sisters. But let's recapture the spirit of the times. Warfare in those days was often brutal and cruel. And when you were living in Israel and saw the fenced cities go one by one as the invader poured across your land, it struck fear through the heart of the Israelites. And in Nahum chapter 2, we have depicted what warfare was really like, Assyrian and Persian warfare. In Nahum chapter 2, we have the Assyrian power indicted. This is the power of which Pul and Tiglath-Pileser were kings. The shatterer, or the hammerer, has come up against you, Nahum 2 verse 1. Man the ramparts, watch the road, gird your loins, collect all your strength. You see how the mighty men are being rallied? When the Median comes and knocks on the gates of Nineveh, the shatterer or the hammerer has come up against you. Man the ramparts, watch the road, gird your loins, collect all your strength. Verse 3, the shield of his mighty men is red. His soldiers are clothed in scarlet. The chariots flash like flame. When mustered in array, the chargers prance. The chariots rage in the streets. They rush to and fro through the squares. They gleam like torches, they dart like lightning. And notice chapter 3. Woe to the bloody city, all full of lies and booty. No end to the plunder. The crack of a whip and rumble of wheel, galloping horse and bounding chariot, horsemen charging, flashing sword and glittering spear. Hosts of slain, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without end. They stumble over the bodies. You know, it's hard for us in a world where, you know, faith is almost pushed to the background, where they're worth the precision of a chronometer, aircraft go in and out of our airport, where people can purchase insurance of many, many different kinds. To think of the Israelite, when he knew there was a power of the Assyrian, described here, woe to the bloody city, all full of lies and booty, no end to the plunder. When those who were beheaded had their heads tied together and strung around live people, when the Assyrian pictures We see pictures of the heads of notable individuals slain, placed in the royal garden. As the passage says here, dead bodies without end. They stumble over the bodies. When they knew the horrors of warfare, brothers and sisters, and when the Assyrians poured down over the land of Israel, think of the fear that would go through the heart of the Israelites as he knew the inevitable end of that kind of conquest. Where men were skinned alive, where men were pegged in the ground and their tongue cut out, that was the warfare of the day. Is it any wonder that faithless men like Ahaz attempted to purchase security from a king like Tiglath-Pileser or Menahem from Pul, and how they would tax the Israelites and impoverish them and strip the gold and silver from the temple to purchase just a little security? You know, think if you were locked in a city for 2 years and the battering rams daily pounded against the walls. Wouldn't that put your faith in an unseen God to the test? Wouldn't that try your faith in Yahweh's unseen chariot who went out on behalf of him? You'd be inclined at every step to rest on Sol, king of Egypt, for his horsemen and his chariot, or to purchase some kind of reprieve by a political alliance. God tested men's character. Time came and time went. Men who endured those great trials, brothers and sisters, are all dead now. And God was fashioning from those extreme circumstances men of notable character. Israelites, some of whom will shine as jewels in God's kingdom. Other men who under the extremity of the situation did not have the kind of faith that could stand the fiery trial, and they perished. And so in 2 Chronicles chapter 23, chapter 36, we have the sad commentary on the kings of Israel. And there we read. Verse 6, for example, of Jehoiakim, against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in fetters to take him to Babylon. At 2 Chronicles 36, verse 7. Nebuchadnezzar also carried part of the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon, and put them in his palace in Babylon. So here the king is taken as a museum piece, put in fetters and transported to Babylon, to be displayed as if he were a museum piece. Of King Zedekiah, verse 14, we read these words. All the leading priests and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of the Lord which he had hallowed in Jerusalem. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words, and scoffing at his prophets, till the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or aged. He gave them all into his hand. Verse 19. And they burned the house of God, and broke down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all its palaces with fire, and destroyed all its precious vessels. He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became his servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbath. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So this is the tragic end of God's ecclesia, Israel and Judah. And there we find that the beautiful house of God was broken down and burned, that the great wall of Jerusalem was smashed, and that the vessels were either destroyed, burned, or taken into Babylon. But here we see God persistently sending his messengers because he had compassion on his people. And therefore the great Ezra could plead that all this hardship might not seem little to the great God of the universe. And I think as we peruse 2 Chronicles 36, it surely is with a sense of dire tragedy that people who were beneficiaries of God's divine providence, of his provision in so many ways, could have stooped and fallen so tragically. Let us remember, brothers and sisters, their faith was tried. Tried by the Assyrians, tried by the Babylonians, and tried by apostasy. And today, as we sit in these seats in this great land of Australia, brothers and sisters, our brothers and sisters are being tried. Their faith is being tried. Their integrity to God's truth is being tried. Let us be valiant like the few men in Israel and Judah, that our God may remember us for good. God was building character in all of the vicissitudes of life in Israel, through all the difficulties that they struggled through, brothers and sisters. Let us not forget that from the divine point of view, God is still fashioning character in all the perplexing areas of life that we find ourselves in today. And so as God removed Israel and removed Judah, the time for the revival of God's people came. And we read of this now in Ezra chapter 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing. Just as God could have said of Assyria, "Ah, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury, against the godless nation I will send him, against the people of my wrath I command him, to take spoil and seize plunder, and to tread down like the mire of the streets. But he does not so intend. His mind does not so think, but it is in his mind to destroy. Assyria, the rod of my anger," said God, "and the staff of my fury." But now we come to a king in quite a different context. Of this king, we read in the prophet Isaiah, chapter 44, "Who says of Cyrus, 'He is my shepherd, and he shall fulfill all my purposes,' saying of Jerusalem, 'She shall be built,' and of the temple, 'Your foundation shall be laid'?" Isaiah 44, verse 28. "Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations before him, and ungird the loins of kings, to open doors before him, that gates may not be closed." On the one hand, you have Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury. On the other hand, you have Cyrus. He is said to be Yahweh's anointed. He is my shepherd. He shall fulfill all my purpose. So whether a king works to bring destruction, or whether he works to revive God's people, the proverb is true. The heart of the king is like water in the hand of God. He turns it with us whoever he willeth. And so with the proclamation of Cyrus, we had God Almighty encouraging Jews to return to their homeland. At this stage, we do well to look at the history of the time. Now, our chart sets this out fairly clearly. We have Levine temple worship through this period of time, terminating with the wicked king Zedekiah. Earlier, God had warned his people through the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar. But the time came when the cup of Jewish iniquity was full, and God sent Nebuchadnezzar with a 2-year siege and the final invasion. And so commenced the 70-year desolation that wasn't to be completed until the work of Ezra and temple worship restored in that period. There was the 70-year captivity of God's people. We have here the favorable decree by Cyrus. Zerubbabel, or Sheshbazzar, and Joshua return with certain people from captivity to restore the altar and to build the temple in Jerusalem. And so we can see here, if you read across, these are the years on the left-hand side, reading down here to the bottom. Here we have the ministrations of the major prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Now remember, the period that we referred to in the time of Menahem, of Pekah, and Ahaz, related to the Assyrian captivity. Now the Assyrian power had experienced a demise. The old Assyrian lion had waxed old, to be usurped by the Babylonian power and the meteoric rise to power under, first of all, Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar. You recall, of course, that the Egyptian power suffered a catastrophic defeat, Pharaoh Necho, at the Battle of Carchemish, and that left, of course, Babylon superior in the ancient world. Babylon then ruled supreme, later to be surpassed by the Medo-Persian kings. In particular, as far as Bible history goes, Cyrus, then we had Cambyses and Pseudo-Smyrnus, the usurper, and for our considerations, the important king, Darius Hystapses. So we need to get a picture of the way the great world powers were located at the time. You see, you had a continual power struggle existing in Palestine. Palestine occupied virtually a buffer between the Egyptian power of the south and the contending powers to the north and the northeast. You had the southeastern Chaldeans. You had to the north the Assyrian power located in Nineveh. And so these powers vied for positioning in Palestine. You see, it was the advantage of the Assyrians or the Babylonians to obtain a foothold in Palestine. There they could pick up men, there they could pick up horses, and use these against the Egyptian power in the south. So as the as Nabopolassar, king of Babylon, and Cyaxares the Median worked together in an alliance to attack Assyria, at this time, the Egyptian power streamed north, destroyed Josiah in the battle at Megiddo, proceeded north to Carchemish, there to be utterly defeated at the hands of the Babylonians. So the Babylonians then ruled supreme, and Nebuchadnezzar then became a tool in God's hands to exercise punishment on the Jewish people to commence the 70-year desolation, the captivity of God's people, as predicted by the prophet Jeremiah. Now, our history then moves through the Babylonian period, this meteoric rise to power, unlike the slow, gradual rise to power of the Assyrian Empire and its relatively slow demise, to the meteoric rise to power of the Babylonians in about 70 short years. And so we pass through the history of Nebuchadnezzar and the other Babylonian kings until we come to the period of Ezra when Cyrus issues his favorable decree. Now it's here that we're going to pick up the narrative as recorded by Ezra. Now Ezra is a big book to work through in one night, and so we're going to impose, as it were, a structure upon this book. And the structure we're going to impose upon it is lessons in revival for God's people. So we'll isolate certain themes and sections of Ezra to see what Ezra was doing, and then we'll proceed to see the way Haggai's prophecy fits in with Ezra's work and the work of Joshua and Zerubbabel. You know, one of the useful things about Bible study is that when you commence a study, sometimes there's a logical cluster study that goes with it. For example, if you commence to study Galatians, Romans in some way is the finished product of Galatians. So it's logical to move in your Bible analysis from Galatians to Romans. Obviously, if one wanted to study 2 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians would also be a good study to begin with. There are cluster studies in God's Word that make for ease in Bible study, and it helps you to retain a greater amount of information when you can correlate your studies. Here it's interesting to note that when you read Ezra, the work of Zechariah and Haggai goes with it. So that really, if one had the time, a study of Ezra would include a study of Zechariah and Haggai, because they were prophets that ministered in this period. And once you get this chronological, this chronology straight, then you see how these writings, Ezra and Nehemiah, fit the overall pattern of God's revelation. Zechariah and Haggai minister during Ezra's time, and when Ezra arrives in Jerusalem, the work has already been commenced by Joshua and Zerubbabel. But when you come to study Nehemiah, of course you have antecedents in Ezra. You have priests named in Ezra, for which significance is placed when you come to study Nehemiah. You see some of the problems commencing in Ezra that become acute when you reach Nehemiah. But when you study Nehemiah, you find that Malachi's prophecy appears to fit in between chapters 12 and 13 of Nehemiah. So it might well be that, as far as chronology goes, Nehemiah is the last book of the Old Testament. It concludes with the temple cleansed. Nehemiah leaves Jerusalem with a revival of God's people in effect. So Malachi appears to make his prophecy between chapters 12 and 13 during a period when Nehemiah apparently had returned to Persia, to Shushan the palace. So our study here then would logically include both Ezra and Malachi if one were to study Nehemiah. And so for the Bible student, he can get, so to speak, maximum mileage from doing a cluster study in working through God's revelation. Well, we've come to examine Ezra then from the point of view of lessons in revival of God's people. And the first principle that we find here is the principle of free giving. Notice, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, verse 2, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of Yahweh, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let each survivor, in whatever place he sojourns, be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods, with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. So we'll set this out then as our first principle in revival of God's people. It's the principle of free giving. And as you can see here, A, free giving itself, and B, of possession. So God's work then commences with the proclamation of Cyrus, and all those of a willing heart, people prepared to give up the considerable affluence apparently they had in Babylon, to leave their social environment, perhaps a source of livelihood that was very convenient. Their social patterns existing in Babylon, and to return to Jerusalem. Now think of what this meant, brothers and sisters. They weren't returning to a city that had hot and cold running water, a city where there were a large number of Jews that were resident within the city. They were returning to a land where the stones were burnt, where the huge stones of the walls and the temple littered the area, and the rubble was so great that when Nehemiah on his donkey went out by the water gate to take a nocturnal inspection, he couldn't go any further because the rubble was so great. They're not going back to an area where people are going to welcome them with open hands. Glad to see you. Come on back. Rather, there's Ashdodites, Ammonites, Philistines, Edomites, Samaritans, all hostile people who do not look favorably upon the Jewish attempts at restoration in Palestine. Now remember, you've got a 4-month journey. You're not going with an armed escort as Nehemiah went with. In Babylon, you may never have been accustomed to riding a donkey. And you can look forward to a very saddle-sore journey for 4 months until you come to an environment that's going to be hostile and formidable. And that's your choice. So you see, if you're a person that had faith, these obstacles would merely afford for you another opportunity for your faith to leap over, and nothing would seem too great. It was God's work, and you were like Epaphroditus, ready to be well nigh sick unto death for the work of God. But if, on the other hand, you were a pretty cautious Christadelphian in those days, if you were a haughty conservative Christadelphian that wasn't accustomed to giving himself very much to the work, then I can assure you the obstacles in Jerusalem would make for staying back in Babylonia and dwelling under your own vine, your own fig tree, and engaging in your commercial enterprises. So if you're going to undertake this trip, there was a principle of free giving. Giving at what would appear to be a high cost. Remember, you've got all sorts of dangers in a 4-month trip and no armed escort, as we'll see. And they had to give of their possessions. Obviously, they had to pay for materials, the timber, for example. They had to pay for the animals for the sacrifices. So there had to be the free giving of one's possession to arise and go. It was the same spirit of the Apostle Paul, who was determined to leave whatever he had in one area and progress, if were possible, even to Spain, to preach in the regions beyond, in cold, hunger, thirst, in want, necessities, hardships, and so on. So you see the same spirit animating these Jews who commenced this long trip to Jerusalem. So they arose and they went. But revival in God's people requires not only faith and a determination to accomplish a goal, it requires unity. So in chapter 3, we have the principle of unity set out. When the 7th month came, and the sons of Israel were in the towns, the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. So the second principle of restoration of God's people is the principle of unity. Now you will recall, of course, that this was a command of the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul commanded that there be no divisions among you. He besought them that they might be united in the same mind and in the same judgment. But brothers and sisters, if God's people are to experience a revival, it must be a revival on a unity of truth. You cannot have a unity existing of a revival of God's people of which truth is not the component. the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. And notice what they did. They began to offer burnt offerings upon the altar which they had built, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Verse 3. They set the altar in its place, for fear was upon them because of the peoples of the land. And they offered burnt offerings upon it to Yahweh, burnt offerings morning and evening. So the unity that they achieved, all Israel being gathered as one man to Jerusalem, was a unity, brothers and sisters, on the basis of giving attention to what was recorded in the law of Moses, the man of God. There are plenty of people for whom Christadelphians could have congenial social compatibility, but when one begins to work on the basis of what God has revealed in his scripture, then the dichotomy begins. And often the dichotomy is permanent, because obviously in their goals and ambitions in life, they're walking in different directions. So they gathered to Jerusalem as one man, and unity of outlook and purpose was based on the second principle of revival, the regularity of worship. An important item, brothers and sisters, that we might well note, because notice in verse 4, and they kept the feast of booths, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number, according to the ordinance, as each day required. We'll come to the Feast of Tabernacles, that joyous celebration, when we study the life of Nehemiah later on. But unity, as Israel gathered as one man, depended upon the principle of free giving of self and possessions and regularity of worship. I'm sure we've all experienced the difficulties that ensue where the Christadelphians do not maintain regularity of worship. It usually breeds apathy and disenchantment in an ecclesia where they can neither withstand the internecine difficulties nor the alien and the opponents outside the wall. So you see, regularity of worship was an important function in the revival of God's people as one man in Jerusalem. The next principle of revival was thanksgiving. And of course, as you can see, these items of revival are interrelated. So our fourth principle relates to thanksgiving. And you notice the joyousness of the people. Not altogether unmingled thanksgiving and joy, as we shall see. Verse 11 of chapter 3. And they sang responsibly, praising and giving thanks to Yahweh, for he is good, for his steadfast love endureth forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised Yahweh, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Joyousness of the people. Not altogether unmingled thanksgiving and joy, as we shall see. Verse 11 of chapter 3. And they sang responsibly, praising and giving thanks to Yahweh, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised Yahweh, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid. Though many shouted aloud for joy, so the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping. For the people shouted with a great shout, and the sound was heard afar. When you think of the great opposition that these Jews faced, where with great fearfulness they watched the movements of the Ashdodites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Samaritans, people, brothers and sisters, who were doing everything they could to frustrate the work. And when by God's grace the altar was made, the altar being restored in its original place, and when the foundations of the great temple which had been destroyed were reset, there were the young men who didn't have a remembrance of the great splendor and glory of Solomon's temple. With youthful enthusiasm, they shouted, they sang, and they praised God responsibly after the manner of the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise Yahweh according to the directions of David, king of Israel. On the other hand, there were the aged men. It was a day of small things in some sense to those men, because as they viewed those the temple site, they saw the very small dimensions of a temple which in no way paralleled the great splendor of Solomon's temple. And so there were the old Jews that were weeping for joy, the young men who were praising and shouting with great glee, so that in this mingled multitude, you couldn't tell the weeping and the joy. For the people shouted with a great shout, and the sound was heard afar off. So thanksgiving, brothers and sisters, an essential prerequisite in people who are reviving for God's work. But there are other principles as well, as unity and regularity of worship and thanksgiving. There is also the principle of purity. And if you notice in chapter 6, verse 20, purity was instituted. The principle of unity depended upon purity. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves together. All of them were clean. So they killed the Passover lamb for all the returned exiles, for their fellow priests and for themselves. It was eaten by the people of Israel who had returned from exile, and also by everyone who had joined them and separated himself from the pollutions of the peoples of the land to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel. And they kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for Yahweh had made them joyful and had turned the heart of the king of Assyria to them, so that he aided them in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So you notice how purity was a prerequisite for a genuine revival in God's people. It required the priests to purify themselves. It required Jews, some of whose children were speaking the language of the Ashdodites and the Ammonites. They wouldn't even know the Hebrew language. When the exiles returned, brothers and sisters, they didn't all stay in Jerusalem. They all went back to their hometown, the hometown of their forefathers. Some went to Beth-Hakkerem. Some to Jericho. They moved back to their old family locations in their various towns. Now, when they did this, of course, there was a chance again of reinfecting, the chance that these local people would exercise their influence over the returned exiles. So purity had to be maintained. They had to separate themselves from the pollutions of the peoples of the land. And this comes up very clearly when other peoples came and tried to assist them in the work, as the Samaritans tried. The Samaritans came along and decided they would help them in the work. But of course, the wise men in the reformation of God's people saw that blood relationship didn't count for anything in God's work where there wasn't the unity of mind over God's work. In other words, unity and purity that accompanied that unity were prerequisites to work in reviving God's people. How could people who merely claim to be Samaritan in origin, mongrel people having some pedigree that was Jewish, but apostate religion, ever experience unity in this word? So you see, they tried to move into God's work on the basis of pedigree, not on the basis of unity through regularity of worship and thanksgiving and purity and other aspects, as we'll see. And in God's work, when we attempt to exhort and revive God's people, brothers and sisters, it must obviously not follow the pattern of the Samaritans, who said, well, we're related to you, why can't we be one with you? But the men of God saw that pedigree didn't count for anything in God's sight apart from unity on the basis of regularity of worship, thanksgiving, purity, and the other aspects that we'll come to. And so the principle of purity was implemented. And the next feature was a very personal one. It occurs in chapter 7, verse 10. The preparation of the heart. This is an essential component of the personal aspect of devotion to God's people. Now we notice the background of Ezra in verse 6. Ezra went up from Babylonia. He was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given him, and the king granted him all that he asked, for the hand of Yahweh his God was upon him. Verse 10. For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to do it. Now he was like Nehemiah. When we come to Nehemiah in chapter 1, we'll find that Nehemiah has prepared himself so that when providence gives him the opening, he can move because he's prepared for it. How many times, brothers and sisters, are we faced with opportunities in life that we can't use because we haven't taken the time to prepare the heart? Like the brother who, through his work, has the capability of going on a world trip involving traveling around the world, and he has to pass over little ecclesias in America where perhaps there's only sisters there because he likes the sightseeing better in the bigger cities, and can't stop to exhort the brethren in Newfoundland because he really can't exhort, because he's never set his mind with the preparation of heart, so that when God would give him the capabilities to do his work, then alas, he wasn't able to take these opportunities. How much is this, brothers and sisters, penned here for our young people? The preparation of heart. You know, when you move up through your late teens and your early 20s, there is a block of time that comes your way there that never seems to really reoccur later in life. When family responsibilities and heavy ecclesial commitments come, the brother doesn't have the opportunity always to study what he would like to study. He can't get the block of time that he would like to get to spend in deep and detailed study of God's Word. But nothing surer today, on an international basis, where apostasy is whittling away against the truth in many areas of this world, it's the man who knows his book that will stand. It's not the man, brothers and sisters, who merely says, I think that it's right, or I know that it's right and I can't prove it. You see, for people who travel internationally, they come into areas of peculiar problems. And the only way they can present a scriptural mind for the edification of people in difficulty is to have prepared their heart to seek the law of the Lord. A powerful exhortation, brothers and sisters, that couldn't be more relevant today when we have difficulties of fellowship in America, where we have difficulties of doctrine in Australia, difficulties of apathy in other countries, It requires men of discretion and wisdom who are tempered and fashioned by having prepared their heart. So that when it comes to freely giving of self, they can do it. When God provides them with the money as custodians of earthly treasure, they can use it to assist brethren in isolation, to help brethren in areas of ecclesial difficulty, because they can bring to bear the wealth of life experiences and the experiences of the men of God in their difficulties and trials in this book. You know, there's an absolute need elsewhere in the world of men of stature who have prepared their hearts. Not only men who are prepared to freely give self, there are people who are prepared to give self freely, but have never grown spiritually. There are men like Meshullam that are prepared to build two sections of the wall physically, but haven't taken the time to prepare themselves mentally and spiritually. And when the opportunities come their way to contribute, they fail in part because they have not given assiduous attention in the time of their youth. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, when the evil days come not, nor the days draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. So to our young people, brothers and sisters, wise words are these. Ezra set his heart to study the law of Yahweh, so that when the time comes for advice, admonition, and to take stand, people can do so on the basis of this book, and not on the basis of a human surmise of the probable outcome of events. And so the preparation of Ezra's heart related to his dependence on God. In chapter 21 of Ezra 8, we see the aspect now of dependence upon God. We'll call this faith for short. But this is a beautiful section of the book of Ezra. In verse 21, Ezra says, Then I proclaimed a fast there by the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God, to seek from him a straight way for ourselves, our children, and all our goods. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, the hand of our God is for good upon all that seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all that forsake him. So we fasted and besought our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. Now we might, you know, merely pass over this as a cursory item in Ezra's diary account here. But you think of the problem he had. He comes before the king and he says to the king virtually, Divine providence is working through you, king, and our God will prosper us on the way. And then he says, Alas, I've got 4 months of journeying. I've got to pass through hostile territory in getting to Jerusalem. Maybe I should have asked him for a contingent of soldiers and horsemen to protect us on the way. Now you think he's got oxen and he's got camels. He's going to have horses with him. He's going to have the golden vessels of the temple. So you see, there's a booty to be obtained by robbers that would lurk on the way. And so Ezra has to think, now I've got responsibilities to these people that have come with me. Ought I not then to have horsemen to go before me? So you see Ezra triumphing here, where King Ahaz, where King Menahem failed in different circumstances. It wasn't the Assyrian this time. It wasn't the Babylonian. But there was Ezra contemplating all the dangers that might lurk on the way in this 4 month journey that he has to Jerusalem. And so he personally says, I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, the hand of our God is for good upon all that seek him. So Ezra can do nothing in these circumstances virtually, but walk by faith. And so with dependence upon God, Ezra goes out leading that multitude up to Jerusalem. And then Nehemiah implements the principle of holiness. In verse 28, you see, it wasn't merely separation from the pollutions of the people. It wasn't merely an exclusion from what was contaminating. It was a sanctifying for a purpose. Verse 28, and I said to them, you are holy to Yahweh, and the vessels are holy, and the silver and the gold are our freewill offering to Yahweh, the God of our fathers. Guard them and keep them until you weigh them before the chief priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses at Israel, at Jerusalem, within the chambers of the house of our God. And so God blessed Ezra. In verse 31 of chapter 8, partway through the verse, we read, the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes by the way. But the principle of holiness, brothers and sisters, had a practical import. It had an import that was very, very difficult. Because in chapter 10, while Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men and women and children gathered to him out of Israel, for the people wept bitterly. Why were they weeping? Because, brothers and sisters, they had married the alien. They had contaminated the people. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, of the sons of Elam, addressed Ezra, we have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. Therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God. And let it be done according to the law. Arise, for it is your task, and we are with you. Be strong and do it. And Ezra mourned over the faithlessness of the exiles in verse 6. And when they assembled, brothers and sisters, in the great open square in verse 9, before the house of God, they trembled, we are told, because of this matter and because of the heavy rain. Verse 13. But the people are many, and it is a time of heavy rain. We cannot stand in the open. What a sad time. But you see, brothers and sisters, in the lessons of the revival of God's people, we've come through these. Principle of free giving, self and possessions. For God loves a cheerful giver, says Paul. Unity based upon regularity of worship, thanksgiving, purity, preparation of the heart, faith, and the principle of holiness. And brothers and sisters, when we come to the principle of holiness, you see the difficulty of implementation. You see the Jews in great bitterness of spirit, weeping over beautiful wives that they'd taken from the heathen, and now they were required to separate. And because Ezra was involved in revival of God's people, did not exempt him, brothers and sisters, from personal difficulty. We might think that if God was so interested in his work in Jerusalem and had blessed him with a safe journey all the way from Babylonia, then surely God could have blessed him by controlling the rain. But it was a time of rain, and the rain beat down upon the people in the open square. You see, God didn't, because Ezra was involved in his work, alleviate him from all the difficulties and vicissitudes of life. No, God was preparing Ezra's character, just like he was preparing the character of Jews that work with him. And if only we can keep this perspective in all our works of life, to remember, brothers and sisters, that trial is a divine university. We're in grave difficulties in Australia, It's a time of great bitterness and a time of difficulty. But brothers and sisters, it's a time of trial. God's fashioning character now like he fashioned it through Ezra. It was a time of rain, a time of bitterness for the people. How are they reacting? How are they reacting? And the same holds true for today. We have to, in our ecclesial policy, operate on the basis of biblical principles. When our character might be defamed, when people might use lacerating comments in regard to our activities in the truth, brothers and sisters, are these hurdles for our faith to leap over or excuses to quit? We can be men like Ezra, men who are prepared to give freely of self and possessions, to have a unity on the basis of regularity of worship and thanksgiving and purity, because we've prepared our hearts to follow the Lord God Almighty. You see, what to one person may be the greatest of catastrophes can be to another man the grounds of great growth in the truth. Australia has a serious problem on the atonement. What in one way, brothers and sisters, has been Australia's problem has been my asset. I would never personally likely have sat down and studied the atonement in great detail. But because of the problems in Australia, I have discovered many rich vein of scriptural treasure in Romans and Galatians and Corinthians because of a problem in Australia. And so you see, because we have a problem, we shouldn't look back and say it's not God's work, or God's not working through our community, or get fed up in one park in isolation, out on some ranch, away from the city, as if to escape the problem. You see, Ezra was right in the thick of the problem. He had men who were hiring other men against him. He had half-hearted allies in his work that wanted to quit. But the vicissitudes of life prepare our character. They're fashioning us through the divine university so that perchance God may look back over our life and remember us for good. Now just take a look, brothers and sisters, of the reaction of the people as depicted by the prophet Haggai. There were difficulties in the land, but God was working providentially. In verse 3, because the work had stopped from Samaritan opposition, look at the way some Jews had responded. They responded, as Haggai says in verse 2, thus says Yahweh of hosts, this people say the time has not yet come to rebuild the house of God. And the word of Yahweh came by Haggai the prophet. Is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in panel houses? Well, this house lies in ruins. Now therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider how you have fared. You've sown much. You've harvested little. You eat, but you never get enough. You drink, but you never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put them into a bag with holes. Boy, what a modern description that is. But there you find Jews in Palestine were taking the stones, very, very numerous in Palestine, as you know, and they were paneling them with cedar and saying, well, the time hasn't come to build Yahweh's house. They weren't preparing the material. They didn't have hearts prepared and seeking out ways of giving of self and of possessions. They were busy paneling their stone houses. And so God worked providentially. God cut off the fertility of the land on them, and they suffered inflation. And so the prophet gave them the word. The prophet gave them the instruction of verse 18. Consider from this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, since the day of the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider, is the seed yet in the barn? Do the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree still yield nothing? From this day on, I will bless you. And so you see, the work of rebuilding the temple was temporarily stopped because of the Samaritan opposition. It required the kings of Persia through Pseudo-Smyrnus until we came to Darius Hystapses, who issued his decree in favor of the continued rebuilding. And so God gave the instruction through Haggai, who ministered to the Jews at the time of Ezra, I will fill this house with my glory, says Yahweh of hosts. That was the encouragement that God was giving to the Jews. And so Haggai's exhortation to consider your ways didn't go unheeded by Jews. You who dwell in your own panel houses, and my house lies waste, says Yahweh of hosts. They dwelt in paneled, cedar panel houses, and God's house laid waste. And so God worked through the conditions of weather to make the Jews suffer, to bring the Jew to realize that it was God's work, that house was to be built by divine decree, that the altar was to be established and the walls reconstructed. And so God gave through Haggai the work of a prophet, the short-term prophecy that if they implemented the instruction of Haggai and commenced to build that house, that God would then bless them in their agriculture. That was the test of God's prophet, that Haggai not only was a prophet, but that God would bless them in the work. And so when we come to Nehemiah, brothers and sisters, Lord willing, tomorrow night, we do so in the background of the sterling work of Ezra, a man of faith who worked through these principles in the revival of God's people. We see the ministration of Haggai, that though the work stopped, Haggai prophesied that God would bless the work and bless them if they continued in the work. And so we commence tomorrow night to examine the work of Nehemiah, a man who came to seek the welfare of the children of Israel.